Welcome to today's topical class. I've been asked to speak on my dissertation that we had to do for the third year of Bhaktivedanta College. And in keeping with the theme of the Bhagavatam class, I looked for a verse that sort of echoed the sentiments that I expressed in my dissertation. And I found such a verse in Canto 1, Chapter 2, and it's verse number 10, which is on the board. And I would like to chant. Kamasya nendriya pritir. Labho jiveta yavata. Jivasya tatva jigyasa. Narto yascheha karmabhi. Please chant. Jivasya tatva jigyasa sarva yascheha karmabhi kamasya nendriya pritir yavo jivate yavata jivasya tatva jigyasa Nato yascheha karmabhi. Mataji. Kamasya nendriya pritir. Tavo jiveta yavata. Nimusya tatva jigyasa. Kamasya nendriya pritir Labho jiveta yavata Kamasya of desires Na not Indriya, senses, priti, satisfaction, labha, gain, jiveta, self-preservation, yavata, so, so much so, jivasya, of the living being, tattva, the absolute truth, jigyasa, inquiries, na, not, artaha, end, yacha iha, whatsoever else, karmabhi, by occupational activities. Life's desires should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation, since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth. Nothing else should be the goal of one's work. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki. The completely bewildered material civilization is wrongly directed towards the fulfillment of desires and sense gratification. In such civilization, in all spheres of life, the ultimate end is sense gratification. In politics, social service, altruism, philanthropy, and ultimately in religion, or even in salvation, the very same tint of sense gratification is ever increasingly predominant. In the political field, the leaders of men fight with one another to fulfill their personal sense gratification. The voters adore their so-called leaders only when they promise sense gratification. As soon as the voters are dissatisfied in their own sense gratification, they dethrone the leaders. The leaders must always disappoint the voters by not satisfying their senses. The same is applicable in all other fields. No one is serious about the problems of life. Even those who are on the path of salvation desire to become one with the absolute truth and desire to commit spiritual suicide for sense gratification. But the Bhagavatam says that one should not live for sense gratification. One should satisfy the senses, in only in so much as required for self-preservation, and not for sense gratification, because the body is made of senses, which also require a certain amount of satisfaction. There are regulative directions for the satisfaction of such senses, but the senses are not meant for unrestricted enjoyment. For example, marriage or the combination of a man with a woman is necessary for progeny, but it is not meant for sense enjoyment. In the absence of voluntary restraint, there is propaganda for family planning. But foolish men do not know that family planning is automatically executed as soon as there is a search after the absolute truth. Seekers of the absolute truth are never allured by unnecessary engagements in sense gratification, because the serious students seeking the absolute truth are always overwhelmed with the work of researching the truth. In every sphere of life, therefore, the ultimate end must be seeking after the absolute truth. And that sort of engagement will make one happy, because he will be less engaged in varieties of sense gratification. And what the absolute truth is explained in the next verses of Bhagavatam, Vedanti Tattva Vidas, and so on. Okay. So on that auspicious note of Bhagavatam, I'd like to begin the class. Om Jnanite Mirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. Narayanam Namaskrityam Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Udiraye Shrimantim Swakata Krishna Punyam Shravana Kirtana Hridayantasto Yabhadrani Vidunoti Sruhitsatam Nasta Praishu Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadam Mayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatha Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha He Krishna Karna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanshakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shrivasari Gaur Bhaktavarna Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. So, this is a very long and elaborate title, I do understand. And I apologize for the Prabhus, whose way I might be in. Please, you're most welcome to scoot over if you like. I'm not sure how I may adjust in terms of the electronic equipment, so please feel free to adjust in case there is something that is not fully visible. So, my big title is my attempt to present academically my paper and basically the topics that I will be speaking on. So if any of the terms seem kind of out there, I hope I will be able to explain it fully and very simply so that it's understandable. This is the title of my dissertation. And in essence, the practices of God consciousness do not exempt us from the turbulence of the material world, but they can surely help us get through it. So basically, I speak about the concept of rasa and how relevant the ideas of the rasa theory are to our lives, our current lives. Usually, rasa theory seems like something that's super higher grade, and it's something generally relegated to the books in our library. And after studying a little bit about it and seeing the relevance of it to our lives, I felt that it's too much to leave this on our shelves and relegate it to the realms of just theater. It should be brought into our daily lives. So in this presentation, I focus on the Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition's view, which advocates the path of emotional bhakti, or devotion for God. And our tradition claims that our adherents can experience true and lasting happiness, even while living amidst the world's turmoil. I especially elaborate on the concept of rasa, or different emotional relationships, and I illustrate that if rasa is properly understood, assimilated, and applied, it can do much to address and rectify the misconceptions of what constitutes well-being in today's highly mechanized worldview. I also show the converse and the misapplication and ill effects of rasa, because I will go into further detail and speak about the nature of rasa and what rasa may mean. But basically, some people have a very perverted reflection and perverted idea, or taste, as it may be. And I show how this is misapplied, this side of taste. Okay. So in essence, this is the contents of my dissertation. For purposes of the class, I have condensed quite a lot to try and keep within the time limit. But in essence, this is what I presented as the dissertation. I had given a synopsis of the nature of rasa and elaborated on the development of Gaudiya Vaishnava rasa concept over time. I presented Rupa Goswami, one of our foremost literary scholars and a noteworthy contributor to rasa's development. I defined the historical context through which rasa theory took shape, and then I looked at the application of rasa to theater. I further examined rasa's application to current life in a section I entitled The Juggle for Existence. Thereafter, I presented a theory of motivation upon scrutiny of individuals' impetus for actions. Why do people do the things that they do? Based on their needs and emotions. And I offer a synthesis of Gaudiya Vaishnava theology in light of contemporary thought. Like, what do modern people have to say, or current intelligentsia have to say about these ideas? And lastly, I present thoughts of other prominent theologians and present-day philosophers concerning the essentiality of emotions, and will offer alternatives to the mechanized perspective. I then concluded with a synopsis and a list of illustrations that I refer to in the paper. But this is a nice part about doing a presentation, because you don't have to wait till the end to illustrate what you're saying. In the presentation, I can just sort of let it flow. So, in my introduction, I speak about how in the present we currently seem to live in a world where practically everything has become objectified. Unless one is like comfortably seated on a psychiatrist's sofa, the tendency is to relegate human emotions to something that's not very significant. However, many of the problems that riddle our society, they're either indirectly or directly related to disturbed mental states or gross negligence of the vital aspects of our human emotions and values that arise from cultivating our natural human emotions. Unfortunately, the emotional platform is not generally viewed as a suitable problem area to begin addressing. We need to have progressive development towards betterment and lasting happiness, and it's really important to begin at this platform. However, this problem is usually misdiagnosed as some external factor. Some theorists claim there's actually no way to achieve a state of world peace or any other utopian state. And this type of skepticism is definitely to be found. It's realistic and certainly has its place in the mind of anyone who has experienced the less than ideal condition of the material world. However, certain segments of the populace differ. Religionists, theologians, and spiritualists, they differ in their perspective on faith. But God-conscious people generally believe in achieving happiness through their practices, through their observances and adherence to the tenets of faith. The potency of their belief and faith in God often shelters them, offering solace and strength in the most trying of situations. And thus the faithful not only persevere, but flourish by growing in character. And Mother Teresa, for me, is such an example of such sterling character and firm faith in a supreme being. There are numerous examples, too many to possibly quantify and expound on. But I focus on our own Gaudiya version of theology. And I mention how my approach can be viewed as what's termed constructive theology. It's an attempt at this to show how classical themes in theology can be applied in a modern and contemporary context. Also from a personal perspective, or my own motivation for doing the paper, when I was a university student, the mood on campus was that you would rather talk about some set of facts of a given situation rather than the cloudier issues of emotions. The whole emotional realm seemed to be unreliable and a little bit unnecessary. The whole world seemed as if it could operate on a more beneficial plane if people could just put aside their emotions and think logically. In retrospect, this inability to accept and interact with the emotional aspect of life has actually been somewhat of an Achilles heel. Because the heart is such, the nature of the heart is such that it's unpredictable, and sometimes it surprises and frightens me. However, I have learned not to take expressions of emotion at face value, because a superficial understanding of important matters prevents one from experiencing the satisfaction of one's true potential. Ignoring or suppressing emotions is antithetical to happiness. The alternative is an informed outlook on how emotions work so that they can not only be recognized, but also appropriately expressed and channeled. And when this art is developed, emotions serve as the most powerful and effective means for realizing one's full human potential. My approach, thus, is to benefit us in some way by looking through such matters. So I begin with the nature of rasa, and the concept or the term rasa mentioned in many of our canonical or scriptural texts such as Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Bhagavat Puran, Bhagavad Gita, and so on, is understood very differently sometimes by different scholars because the exact English equivalent is very hard to find. The closest equivalent in the English language would probably be the words mellow, or taste, relish, pleasure, or the sweet taste of a loving relationship. The term is very rich in meaning, but it can be briefly understood as the culminating result of relishing a divine emotion. Shri Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he quotes very beautiful statements. Maybe you could please read for us, Maharaj. Those very beautiful descriptions that we find of rasa, what rasa means, and how rasa is something that is relished by devotees. And it's a very integral and key concept of our tradition. And there is a lot to elaborate on in this section. However, for time purposes and time constraints, I will shorten quite a bit and jump ahead to the five primary rasas, which are described as Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, Madhurya. And the five corresponding rasas or moods are passive awe and reverence, servitude, friendship, parenthood, and conjugal love. And we understand that these relationships, any one of these relationships, can be forged or connected to with Krishna. And in the ultimate sense, this is how our emotions, our relationships should actually be in relation to Krishna. However, we do have these relationships here in the mundane world also. And we understand that everything here is a perverted reflection of the supreme or the ultimate form of these rasas. However, besides these five primary rasas or relationships, there are seven secondary rasas which consist of laughing, having wonderful visions, entering into chivalrous relationships, experiencing pity, feeling anger, and experiencing ghastliness and devastation. Secondary rasas sometimes appear to enrich the flavors and tastes of the primary ones, after which they disappear. So, the analogy of the wave and waves of the ocean, how they appear and disappear. So like this, the supporting rasas, they come, they enrich a certain flavor, a certain mood and relationship to Krishna, and they disappear, depending on the situation. And Srila Visharat Chakravarti Thakur, one of our prominent Gaudiya Vaishnavas, points out to us that various people, like the wrestlers in the wrestling arena, Kamsa and impious rulers, perceive Krishna as dangerous, angry, or threatening. And threatening because they fail to understand the actual position of the personality of Godhead. Actually, Lord Krishna is everyone's friend and well-wisher, but because we rebel against him, he chastises us, and thus we may perceive him as threatening. Krishna, or God, is actually merciful, and when he punishes us, this is also his mercy. Here, Srila Prabhupada, in the context, we're speaking about the punishment of demons. And he quoted Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and he spoke about how even the chastisement of the Lord is actually mercy. He's our well-wisher. He's not chastising us because he wants to be mean. He chastises us because it's usually for our own benefit. And even those who are chastised by the Lord benefit in the sense that they are given liberation. Or we could quote the famous example of Putana, who was there to try and kill Krishna. However, she achieved position, the elevated position of Krishna's own, as one of Krishna's own mothers. I then spoke about the Gaudiya Vaishnava development of rasa, and I quoted a lot from a scholar called David Haberman, who explains the process of sadhana bhakti, or how to cultivate, how to at least begin the process. Although it's very elevated and very elaborate, you know, there are steps that help one or assist one the entire way. And Haberman explains in his book, Acting as a Way of Salvation, many of the moods, the rasas, that are in keeping with our own siddhanta. And he explains the process of sadhana bhakti, vaidhi sadhana bhakti, through a structured process according to the scripture and our spiritual authorities, and raganuga bhakti, whereby through this following one develops attachment and thus can perform spontaneous service or has a spontaneous relationship with the Lord. Love for Krishna or Keshava. As previously described, reaches the supreme state of being composed of mellows when its ingredients are fulfilled. By means of vibhava, anubhava, sattvika and vyabhichari, hearing and chanting are activated, and the devotee is able to taste love for Krishna. Then attachment for Krishna, or permanent ecstasy, which is asthaya bhava, becomes the mellow of devotional service, or bhakti rasa. When I hear this quote, I always thought of the example of a cell phone. And, you know, the word activate in that sense made me think of this. Where you have a cell phone, you have a SIM card, and you have all the tools basically there, necessary and ready. But only when you actually put the SIM card into the cell phone and you activate it, you get it operating and like that, then do you actually use it? Then does its purpose become fulfilled? So like that, all the ingredients could be, you know, present, but unless it's put into its proper context and use, then only can these elements become actively what they're meant to be. And I sort of tried to summarize the five fundamental kinds of bhavas that are described in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And maybe you guys can read them just to refresh in case, you know. Someone like to read, please? Yes, please, Majavara. Thank you very much. So, I speak more about this in my paper, about how these different moods or bhavas interact to produce the highest transcendental emotions that one can experience in relation to the Lord. But at the same time, I looked at how we could cultivate these transcendental emotions. And one of the ways was through theater, and it seemed like something really strange at first, because my first ideas or impressions of theater was going to a Macbeth play with my school friends, and of course there were different emotions that were portrayed, but it was nothing that I related to directly. And the point that I'm trying to make is, usually when there is something being portrayed that we relate to, it usually affects us on some profound level. Maybe not hugely profound, but significantly enough to impact us. And we take away this type of experience. And there are many different people who have different views on this also. One of them being Abhinavagupta, who mentions, he was a Kashmiri Shaivite, and he mentioned that these type of experience are actually meant to, well, they're used in the sense of a stepping stone to actually achieve Brahman, or, you know, impersonal, or idea of impersonal liberation. So his idea was that we need to experience all these emotions, but actually the ultimate goal is to, you know, detach oneself from all these emotions. However, Rupa Goswami and Bharata Bhojadev, we have different opinions about this idea. Bhojadev says that this experience in the theater can only be felt in the theater. It's not felt after you leave the theater. However, I think it was Bharata and Rupa Goswami that say, actually, these experiences, they can be experienced in the theater as well as outside the theater, taking it into the sphere of our lives, our, you know, reality. And these experiences, well, Abhinavagupta says that only one who has particular qualifications or vasanas or the mental impressions can experience such a rasa. However, Rupa Goswami and Bhoja, they explain how anyone who actually is interested in experiencing these high emotions can become worthy, can train themselves through our process to enable us to experience these emotions. And I sort of spoke about many different people who have contributed significantly to the development of rasa, and I wasn't able to speak about all of them. I did, however, make a timeline, though it's not very legible here. It's in my paper for clear reference. But I did make a very detailed timeline showing the significant contributors to the rasa theory and rasa development. So these are the different views that I looked at in application to theatre. And Viola Spolin was also a very prominent figure in theatre, in contemporary theatre. And her views also were similar to that of Rupa Goswami. His idea of the vasanas, but it sort of paralleled with her ideas of becoming stage worthy. In her introduction, she mentions that anyone can become stage worthy. Anyone who undertakes the necessary process of training themselves, they can become an actor. They can play in the theater as they desire, but it works only according to their own desire. So I looked at the application of rasa to life. Coming from such a transcendental sphere, looking on the level of bhava, and then I looked at how that actually fits into our day-to-day, our current life. And in my final year of my degree, when I did a Bachelor of Commerce, the mood was that human potential seemed to refer to something very different. It referred to how fast and successfully one could establish oneself in the corporate world during the ages of 18 and 65, which is the most productive years of one's life. And this is what society generally dictated as socially acceptable. And it's not that I'm advocating that we should not have a job or, you know, cultivate or work towards an occupation. The problem for me was that I felt when this occupation overrides one's life, basically eroding away one's human emotional and spiritual well-being in the process, then it becomes a problem. I wrote a piece entitled The Juggle for Existence, which is an excerpt from my paper, and I'd like to read it. We have become products of a consumer-based society, products from a long supply chain of the treadmill living of life, a hard-knock life of earning and burning, income, which begins for the sake of keeping up with the Joneses, but only leads to the inevitable debt crisis. Marketers implement the psychology of marketing or other such techniques which study human behavior and social needs. Corporations in particular tend to use knowledge of the human psyche, conscious and subconscious, to override people's emotions. As a result, people become objects, gently labeled as consumers. Ruthlessly, this process starts young. As psychologist Alan D. Kanner, PhD, attests in Rebecca Clay's article for the Journal of American Psychological Association. Advertising is a massive multi-million dollar project that's having an enormous impact on child development. The sheer volume of advertising is growing rapidly and invading new areas of childhood, like our schools. The result is not only an epidemic of materialistic values among children, but also something he calls narcissistic wounding of children. Thanks to advertising, he says, children have become convinced that they are inferior if they don't have an endless array of new products. Thus, marketing ethics in advertising and promotion, also related to media ethics, is fraught with loopholes of disregard for the moral principles behind the operation and regulation of marketing. There are general unspoken, unwritten, and unassumed beliefs that govern our behavior as rational beings. However, Ian Mitroff and Appleson dare to write these beliefs down and elaborate on the deception that they cause. In Swans, Swine, and Swindlers, coping with the growing threat of mega-crisis and mega-messes, they write concerning the uncovering of assumptions. To succeed, you have to make difficult decisions. And to make the best decisions, emotions have to be put aside. There is no room for bleeding hearts. If in order to get ahead, you have to fire your best friend, then don't think twice about doing it. If you don't do it, you're a wimp. So these are some of the unspoken sort of rules that govern one generally when one enters into the corporate sphere. And before I actually visited some individuals who were already part of the corporate world, you know, the corporate world seemed like, you know, the place I was going to be in, the place that I'm naturally headed to after I finished my degree. But when I observed these types of practices after 2 months at one of these big corporate firms, it sort of shattered my entire view. This whole idea of human potential that I had before, this whole idea of, you know, making it out there, so to speak. The general scheme of operation that I observed of one who is part of the corporate world was quite a shock to my system. In our general scheme of operation, one wakes before sunrise and has to perform austerities during the early morning hours in preparation for the day's functioning and survival. Leaving home prematurely only to sit in bumper-to-bumper traffic on the mega highways, luxury automobiles designed for speed crawl at snail's pace. Office-bound, one is juxtaposed with the mind and adrenaline, which are revving up under the stress of time and caffeine. Passions flare over parking bays or fellow commuters' unbrisk paces. This marks the beginning of a driven, time-ruled, and ambitious day. The 9-to-5 rat race commences, although having begun many vital hours before. People spend their time, energy, and lives in occupations they often hate. Dealing with competitive, envious co-workers, and at the very least, a demanding boss, usually akin to the devil. We find many satirical comedies, many movies, and, I mean, usually the boss is portrayed as the worst character because he rules your life. What he says makes or breaks you, basically. Dressing to the dictates of fashion moguls and eating according to the dictates of size, one vies in this marketplace for prestige, popularity, or fornication. After the day is done, having been spent in the mad rush to produce the required goods, one lunges out into the streets of the concrete jungle again. The journey home is a stark reminder of the survival of the fittest. As the end of the day's frustrations spew out in various manifestations of hustle and road rage, daycare, aftercare, and gym, wrestle for time with dinner and the television, and numerous social networking websites, like Facebook and Twitter, chat rooms and the news, as much as one can squeeze in, before it's time for a prized yet short amount of slumber, just enough to keep one sane. This is, of course, unless one is in the unfortunate position requiring a second or third source of income, in which there is no rest for the wicked. The unending race against time is never actually won, because the opponent is immortal and relentless, never halting for any man. Anyone who has unconsciously or unintentionally hit the snooze or cancellation button on their alarm and found themselves in dire situations could adequately attest to this experience. Then at pre-dawn, the vicious cycle begins anew, with an assortment of alarm bells ringing off like a death toll. Against one's will, one staggers on. The rising and setting of the sun signal the beginning and the end of the day, another day of our own lives, spent racing around in doggish circles, not quite catching our tail. Yet, we are so engrossed in trying that we fail to notice as the days of our own lives pass us by. Day after day, week after week, month and year. Just as we fail to see the sunlight or take stock of our human emotions. Existing on this type of platform generates the core of an objectified existence, wherein finer emotions have no place alongside our ambitions. In Reality, Spirituality and Modern Man, author David Hawkins elaborates on technology and modern conveniences which fail to solve the problems, the basic problems of human existence, and have degraded further under the onslaught of media barrage. History has certainly revealed examples of the products of such an existence, and the sometimes misguided revolts against it. The case in question that I spoke about when I mentioned the products of such an existence was the gruesome Columbine School massacre, which occurred on April 20th, 1999, in which students, Dylan and Eric, killed 12 students, a teacher and themselves. To everyone else, they seemed like routine teenagers, but a glimpse into one of their emotionally charged writings spoke volumes about the internal state of these two kids. On the front page of Harris's journal, he wrote about how he hates the world. He hates racists. He hates martial art experts and people who brag about their cars. You know what else he hates? People who drive slow in the fast lane. God, these people do not know how to drive. These are the sentiments, some of the basic sentiments that he was expressing in his journal. He wrote many other things, and even the date on which they performed the massacre seemed to coincide with the 110th anniversary of Adolf Hitler's birthday. An essential question for me revolved around a key word, motive. What kind of perverted or ghastly rasa or taste could possibly motivate people to perform horrific acts of violence? How do these individuals manage to derail themselves from life and emotions such as love, happiness, and the very humaneness that governs our being? In the next section, I address different ideas of impetus, emotions, and I introduce Abraham Maslow. He is a famous psychologist, and he has a theory of motivation. So he's also known as the father of modern management, because his theory is used a lot in the commercial world to show how consumers' needs would affect their purchasing ideas. So Maslow was one of the people who actually studied mentally healthy individuals, such as Einstein, instead of people who had major disabilities mentally. And he did this in trying to prove that human beings are not only reacting to certain situations in their lives, but actually they're trying to accomplish something great, something meaningful in their lives. And this is Maslow's pyramid, which represents graphically represents his motivation theory. His idea is that we have many different types of needs, and on different levels of the pyramids, we have different levels or different we place different amounts of importance on these needs. So the lower order needs that are reflected on the first two levels or tiers of the pyramid are needs that he says that if they're not fulfilled, one cannot progress onto the higher levels of our being. Or one who does not have the lower order needs fulfilled cannot move up onto the higher order needs. So in essence, if one is actually unsure of where to obtain their food, clothing, or shelter from, in his argument, he states that how can then one develop the higher moods? How can then one think of self-actualization if one is in a poverty-stricken situation, or you know, someone is starving and living from hand to mouth? Why then would they look at something like self-actualization? Would it even feature in their lives? And that's one part of the argument. But I've also noticed that in respect to morality or religious practice, this may not necessarily be true. Because sometimes people in the most poverty-stricken situations, or people who are experiencing emotional turmoil, tend to also look for self-actualization, or tend to look for some kind of meaning to life. They start their search from that point, where there is some sort of trial, tribulation, or suffering. And I do elaborate further on that point later on. But here, I'd like to reinforce how Maslow speaks that everyone has some kind of desire to understand, you know, who am I? This innate desire is there in people. Usually it comes for different reasons. Either the questions like, why am I suffering? Or why do the loved ones surrounding me suffer? But when I looked at the idea of impetus and motivation, I saw that a closer examination of an individual's life or circumstances, this could show possibly why an individual performs the actions that he does. The family background of an individual, as I've looked at certain case studies, and the family background in particular played a very deep and profound role in shaping the individuals that I spoke of. One may find the deepest motivating reasons for individuals to conduct the particular research and develop the particular theories that they do. And this can be viewed as a parallel to ascertaining an initial type of rasa, studying the conditions under which it was developed, and then what it eventually transformed into. So these were the people that I looked at in detail in my case study section. I looked at the lives of Abraham Hayes, Harold Maslow, the psychologist that I spoke of before, Charles Darwin, you probably are very familiar with his name and the evolutionary theory, Sigmund Freud, who's also a philosopher, and Adolf Hitler, one of the most severe cases that I've ever studied. I come from South Africa, so I don't really know much about European history, but since I've spent time here in Radadesh, I've learned a little bit about it, heard more about the war or wars and how they've affected people's lives in such profound and sometimes negative ways. You hear the horror stories of war, and then you also hear about tremendous stories of courage and human determination. It's really amazing. But for the purpose of my paper, I looked at how Hitler actually operated in terms of his psychology. And I'd like to read a little excerpt from this. One of the severest cases of emotive questioning and subsequently negative pursuances that I have researched thus far would be Adolf Hitler. His most dysfunctional and unorthodox family structure, lineage, and upbringing would seem strongly linked to his disastrous motivated actions. Hitler's father, Alois, was the illegitimate son of Maria Ann Schickelgruber. There is no certainty as to who his father was. However, one of Hitler's henchmen, Hans Frank, stated during the Nuremberg trials in 1945 to 1946 that Hitler's grandmother, Maria, was said to have been employed as a domestic worker in the household of rich, wealthy Jewish family called Frankenberger. Their 19-year-old son allegedly impregnated her and regularly sent her money after the birth of Alois. If this is true, this would make Hitler's father half-Jewish, and thus Hitler a quarter-Jewish. Hitler's father's third marriage at the age of 47 occurred with his father's legal niece, Hitler's mother, Clara Plotz, when she was 25 years old and already pregnant by him. It is stated that throughout the marriage ceremony and throughout their relationship, she continued to address him as uncle. This was not the first instance of incest and inbreeding in the family history, which was consequently riddled with various physical and mental illnesses. Hitler's real fear then was not that someone would discover that he had a Jewish grandfather, but that it would someday come to light that he carried a hereditary disposition towards mental illness and retardation. Is it any wonder then that Hitler, when he came into power, he passed laws such as the Nuremberg Laws, banning marriage between non-Jewish and Jewish Germans, and forbidding the employment of non-Jewish women under the age of 45 years in Jewish homes? Is it surprising that a key Nazi concept was the notion of racial hygiene? Or that Hitler's early eugenic policies specifically selected children with physical and mental disabilities in a program that he dubbed Action T4? These are very specific connections between his family history and later legally enforced actions. They're highlighting more than mere coincidence, rather the deep-rooted emotional seating for one's impetus to act. So here are some images that I found in my research of Hitler as a young child. And his consequent evolution as a troubled being from boyhood, his youth, and eventually his manhood, which he describes many of his struggles in his sort of autobiography called Mein Kampf. And I really struggled on this point to understand how it works that someone who has these type of emotions could project this onto other people. And because one suffers so much, they feel the need that others should suffer also. And the point, though, that I was making is that these feelings of dissatisfaction, deep dissatisfaction, escalate to a point where one is then able to act on them. As Maslow says, these lower order needs, when they're not fulfilled, they cause definitely some kind of dissatisfaction. But when dissatisfaction escalates to such an extent that it becomes something traumatically bad, then one reaches the point of committing these types of gross violent acts. For a human being to reach the point of inflicting this type of gross violence and killing another being, one generally dehumanizes them. So I looked at how this process of dehumanization takes place. And when one brings to a lower level other people, People are then viewed as things or objects, which can be utilized in the manner that one utilizes things or objects, and they become expendable according to the whims of those in a so-called superior position. So ultimately, this is the methodology that he used when he dealt with people, to dehumanize them, to bring them to a level of vermin, or as he mentioned, bacilli, type of virus that needs to be extinguished. That was his mood. So I asked certain questions about this. Could the ghastly rasa actually be akin to the horrors inflicted by Hitler and others? As described earlier, according to Bhagavata theology, the fearful or ghastly rasas in connection to God are actually beneficial for those whom he kills. And this is definitely not the case when mortals try to play God. This is an absolute perversion of this type of a rasa. However, there has to be some type of taste for someone to be so emotively moved to perform these type of acts. And I found a very pertinent quote to this, which exemplifies this. Every one of us within the world is perpetually engaged in some sort of service or action. And the impetus for such service is the pleasure we derive from it. Driven by affection for his wife and child, a family man works day and night. A philanthropist works in the same way for the love of a greater family, and a nationalist for the cause of his country and countrymen. That force which drives the philanthropist, the householder, and the nationalist is called rasa, or a kind of mellow relationship whose taste is very sweet. So the point is that if there is no taste, if there is no rasa, one cannot really perform these activities, these acts. So even in performing, you know, horrific or violent or ghastly acts, one develops such a taste for these type of things and is thus able to perform them. And then offered a synthesis, because these amazing experiences or transcendental rasa that I briefly described before, and you know, the cruelty and the, you know, the ghastliness of the emotions sometimes that exist in this world, there seems to be such a huge gap. Sometimes some people wonder whether, you know, these type of things are relevant at all to us in this day and age, and if it's relevant to our lives at all. And in my synthesis section of the paper, I offered some sort of idea of how it can be applied in this context. I speak about how human needs, feelings, and emotions that affect one on profoundly deep levels may not be on a spiritual or transcendent platform. Although not the ultimate form of emotion, this experience nevertheless gives one a glimpse of what our relationship with the Supreme is meant to be like. So yes, we don't necessarily experience everything on the level of bhava, on these greatly elevated levels, but this should not dissuade us from seeing the integrity or the essentiality of our human emotions. They should not be negated to an extent where we feel completely, we feel completely that there is no place for me in this highly elevated process. Many of our own practitioners suffer in this way when they come to know of, you know, extremely high levels of rasatiri, for example. They feel very despondent. You know, first, in the material world, we're told that our emotions are not necessary. And then we come into the movement and we realize that, oh, our emotions, or whatever we feel in this material world, is actually just a perverse reflection of what is the actual spiritual or the highest emotions are meant to be like. And it can be quite discouraging that, you know, okay, so what do I do with these emotions? I'm still an emotional being by nature. You know, what am I supposed to do with it? So our movement has many examples of Yeah, of course, the negativities that are associated with repressing these emotions or not properly channeling these emotions. And the need for love, for familial association, these type of needs are not something that are going to go away by suppressing them. We need to address what is important for us, emotionally as well as spiritually. But the point is that our emotional needs need to be addressed. It's not something that will just go away if we focus on our spirituality, and eventually the emotional evolutionary cycle will just happen. To some extent, when people are surrendered to that extent, it may be possible. But generally, for us, struggling practitioners, we're spiritual beings and we're struggling in this material world. And for us, it can be very debilitating sometimes to encounter such elaborate theories and to see how we could possibly fit into its context. But this needs to be done. We need to ascertain on what level we're actually at and how to maybe progress into to the next levels, into the higher levels, and to thereby achieve the highest goal at some stage. But the idea is that we need to start somewhere. And then, in order to persevere, we can figure out where it is that we want to go. Yeah, there's four more. So rasa and the emotions, these are something that I showed actually they can be portrayed in our theology, where we speak of examples of jivan muktas. These are people who are actually here amongst us, but they can actually be on the liberated platform. We may not actually know this, but necessarily when the person is here. But the point is that bhakti and rasa, it's such an internal process. And it's not something that is seen as exclusive to Gaudiya Vaishnava theology. Many other different religions have sort of similar concepts to this, where one can actually be a saint while still alive. Although actually, in some religions, the sainthood is only actually bestowed after the person passes away. But the point is that this concept is still there and very relevant. So I was propounding on this point that one must consider it, at least emotions have a valid and intrinsic place in our existence. And even if they may not be on these highly advanced levels, they can still motivate us to work towards the higher ideal. Human beings are not mechanical, and we should not be expected to conduct ourselves as such. So I have the analogy of a cake in this respect. And I looked at the idea of the outsider versus insider perspectives and how one could possibly study rasa on just theoretical basis. And Srila Prabhupada also uses a similar example about the jar and the honey contained within the jar. But here the idea is that one bakes a cake. One may study the method in which the cake is being baked. He studies the ingredients before and after and the baking process. However, if one fails to actually eat the cake and taste it, what's the point? It's wonderful to document and study these kind of things. But the whole point sometimes one would question, why bake a cake? The point of baking the cake is actually to eat it, to taste it. In that sense, you know what a cake is. So like that also, if you're after honey or trying to understand rasa, if you can study it from the outside of the jar, but unless you actually open the jar, actually take a scoopful and taste it, how would you actually know what rasa and all these elaborate terms and processes involve? What are they about? So I offered an argument in that sense. And I spoke of many alternate thinkers, such as David Hawkins, Martha Craven Nussbaum and Matthew Stain. These are different alternative thinkers who have similar views that civilization is misguided and we need help, basically. We need assistance to get back into the right direction. And Mr. Hawkins is not to be confused with Dawkins, who is actually an atheist. And it's interesting to actually note that atheistic propagandists, they have a new argument where they're trying to find it necessary to search for emotional arguments against religion, because logically objectifying our existence is not effective enough to convince people. So now they're really looking for emotional reasons like this. One of the images that I saw on their recent discussion forums was Converts Corner, where one is seeing converting. There's a Christian rosary, and one converts from Christianity to science. And I actually saw this, and I thought, oh, well, it can also go the other way, where one comes from a scientific basis and actually looks to theology for answers that science falls short of giving them. So instead of just looking at our DNA, we actually pick up a rosary or a japa mala and we get into it. So, conclusion. Which pretty much is essentially here. And this is the greatest tragedy when what is essential to our very being is misdirected in such a way that it becomes something meaningless. My research confirmed and deepened my conviction concerning the indispensable value of emotions as opposed to an objectified consumerist approach to existence. That ignored or misdirected emotions can cause unfathomable havoc in the cases of the Columbine Massacre and Hitler's regime indicates how appropriately informed and channeled emotions are the means for the highest good. These were the most negative cases that I had studied, amongst the others. But the opposite is also true, that when we have appropriately informed and appropriately channeled emotions, they are actually the means for the highest good, for self-realization or self-actualization and the fullest potential of happiness. This is not exclusively the view of Gaudiya Vaishnava theology concerning rasa, but is also confirmed by modern theorists and philosophers who have delved deeply into the matter, such as Maslow, Nussbaum, and Hawkins. It is thus the greatest tragedy, as I mentioned before, when these emotions are just mischanneled or misapplied and misdirected. In this regard, Gaudiya Vaishnava rasa theory is more than a quaint religious view. Rather, it is a dynamic parallel to some of the most insightful and genuinely compassionate thinkers of our time. More than this, it can be a powerful tool for assessing and evaluating and elevating our emotional status in order to enhance our present existence and make progress towards ultimate perfection. Thank you very much for your time and patience and bearing with me through my academic presentation of a beautiful rasa theory. Some comments, questions, and corrections, please. We'll probably just have 2 minutes or so, and maybe we could speak about it individually afterwards. But at this point, class is officially over. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Shri Prabhupada Ki.